So now I'm very happy to welcome David Lyon. Please come to me and have a seat. He will give us the keynote speech. David Lyon is a researcher and writer on social issues. He is director of the Surveillance Project and professor of sociology. Just to name a few of his academic roles, he has written many books. The most recent one is called Surveillance Studies, an Overview, which was published this year. And other important titles are Surveillance After September 11 or Surveillance as Social Sorting, Privacy, Risk and Digital Discrimination. He is a member of many international editorial boards. His work has been recognized also with various awards. And to give some private information, he's married to Sue. He has 4 adult children. 1 son is with him at the Ars Electronica, and 2 grandchildren. And he also writes songs and paints in watercolor. So, David, you are a very, very busy man, and Armin and I were really glad when you accepted our invitation. Because we are convinced that this approach of surveillance, a social sorting, is a very important one and was fundamentally important for the concept of this conference. So maybe before you start with your keynote speech, because you are also director of this surveillance project, which is a global international research project on this topic, which is very important, maybe you can give us just a short idea about this research project. What are the focuses of this research?
Yeah, thanks for the welcome. The project at Queen's is one in which we look at all kinds of surveillance. It is to do with consumer surveillance, state surveillance, all manner of surveillance forms. So I have PhD students working on customer relationship management and consumer surveillance, another on CCTV, another working on Facebook, another who was working on the surveillance of Turkish migrant workers in Germany. So we look at a whole range of surveillance issues, and it is multidisciplinary. So I'm in sociology, but I work with colleagues from information science, computer science, political studies, philosophy. We have people from a range of different perspectives. And just because what we're looking at is so large, we know that we have to work with others from different disciplines, different perspectives, and also internationally. So although a lot of what we look at is in the North American, Europe, axis, we're also very interested in developments in China, India, Japan, and other countries as well.
And you are connected and also exchange this information. And why is it so important to approach the issues of surveillance from all these different angles, from all these different perspectives?
Surveillance today is deeply bound up with what you might call governance, ways in which both established authorities like the nation state, but also ordinary corporations are involved in managing and manipulating and contributing to the direction of people's lives. So from the point of view of governance, it's really important. Political studies has to go well beyond what it used to talk about, which is the nation state. It has to talk about all kinds of power relationships. And within those, surveillance has become tremendously important. I mean, we would argue that it is the emerging organizational form in the 20th century.
Okay. Thank you so much. Now we are very curious on your presentation. Thanks.
want to make some comments this afternoon about surveillance, and I'm going to try to focus on that surveillance theme. I do want to thank the organizers for the invitation here. It's been extremely stimulating, and especially for the choreography of Ina and Armin, who have held things together, I think, in an exemplary fashion. And it's exciting to be part of an event like this. Surveillance. Surveillance. Überwachung. We're talking about something that is very visual in the metaphor that is used to explain it. Sometimes it is literally visual, but it's also literarily visual. And I want to play a little bit with those ideas. And that connects us very much with the festival overall and the themes of visibility and invisibility, mutual visibility, of the visible being made visible by invisible means and invisibility being produced by the visible. All these things are here, sometimes, to make it more complicated, in metaphorical form and sometimes in literal ways. There's also another set of connections that we have here in Linz during the festival. And that is the connection between spheres that 10 years ago people talked about as if they were kind of separate spheres of the cyber and cyberspaces and concrete real places. I don't believe there ever was such a radical separation between the spheres, but for those who developed narratives to suggest that there were such divisions, those narratives are certainly dissolving now, such that, and as we see it in so many of the presentations and installations around here and in some of the talks here yesterday and today, those two are intricately involved with each other in tremendously important ways. So the visible, the invisible, the metaphorical and the physical, the connection between real spaces and supposed cyber spaces are all important for what I want to say. There is a plan, for example, in the United States in urban areas to connect discrete CCTV systems. So visual video surveillance systems in public places. There are several projects based on the idea of making them connected. Not just connected in a physical kind of sense, but connected digitally so that data can be produced from them in an integrated fashion. Seeing, whether literal or literary, is now mediated by systems and devices of all kinds. Seeing is always mediated, of course, but today the kinds of devices that mediate that seeing are crucial to what is seen and how visibility is made possible. Those devices and those systems are above all computing power and also the power of statistics and statistical reasoning. We haven't said all that much about statistics, and I don't plan to say all that much about statistics either. However, it is crucial to the ways in which databases and data mining that relate very closely to surveillance in all its varieties actually operate. Let me just say what I think surveillance is all about. Surveillance is any focused, systematic, routine attention to personal details. And I should say in parenthesis that those personal details may be discovered through things or information flows, as well as through actual attention to things like credit card swiping or being seen on a video camera. So it's attention to personal details, but the details may come because of the objects with which we're associated, the environments within which we're moving, or whatever. So it's attention to personal details, focused, routine, and so on. But not just that. to be surveillance, that focused attention must be for certain kinds of purposes. And the purposes are crucial. The purposes include things like management, control, entitlement, protection, influence, and the list could go on. But those purposes for which surveillance is carried out are vital to the sorts of surveillance that emerge. So attention to personal details for certain kinds of purposes. But what is this social sorting that you have heard I want to associate with the word surveillance? It's because of the social sorting that is now endemic to all forms of surveillance, as I've just defined it, that privacy becomes less and less salient. Privacy, as conventionally understood, is simply less relevant to a world in which this kind of surveillance occurs. So that's why I think it's important. What it is that the kinds of surveillance that I'm describing are ones in which the purpose is to classify, is to organize into categories those data that are collected. And there's purpose behind that, of course. Putting those data in certain categories is intended to enable certain kinds of judgments and decisions to be made about those data and, by extension, the persons to whom they refer, or to the groups within which those persons are a part. So the social sorting is the ways in which we are routinely and automatically and usually remotely categorized and classified by these surveillance systems. And we're put in different kinds of groups so that we can be treated differently according to the criteria, according to the category in which we are placed. So let's think of a concrete example of that, and there are many. Geodemographic marketing, geo being the placing, where people are, and the demographic, the characteristics of those people. Geodemographic marketing that depends upon database understanding, surveillance based on database organization. Now, obvious example, the call center. Felix Stalder mentioned the bank and the ways in which you might call a bank and you might wonder why you are on the line waiting for something to happen for a period of time. Well, an awful lot of services today go through call centers. And call centers are frequently automated such that the origin of the call intervenes between your making the call and the call being received, so that you call the call center you're looking for after sales service or something, and before the call is answered, it is routed according to the postal code or zip code from which the telephone call originates. And from the postal code is already determined the geodemographics, the characteristics of those who live in that particular neighborhood. They're divided, well, in the United States and Canada and in several European countries. Everyone is classified one way and another. You're in the pools and patios neighborhood, or you are in the shotguns and pickups neighborhood, or bohemian mix, or rural, hard scrabble, lots of categories in which people are placed. And that also is connected with zip codes and postal codes. So you call from an upscale area and immediately the call is answered, and you are given various kinds of options of preferential treatment, special discounts, special kinds of service. You will be wooed, seduced, drawn into the relationship with whatever it is that they're trying to sell. If you come from, let's say, rural hardscrabble, and the telephone call about after-sales service derives from there, you will pick up the phone, and you will, after a few moments, hear the words, "Your call is important to us. Please stay on the line until the next available agent is ready to serve you." And you'll wait, and you'll hear that again. And you'll wait, and you'll hear it again. And if you wait long enough, if you have the temerity to stay on the line, your call will be answered indeed by someone who has been specifically trained to get callers off the line as quickly as possible. So there are various ways of conducting this. I'm talking about a real system that I'm not going to identify, but there are many like that. And that's what I mean about the pre-sorting based on personal data, in this case aggregated from geodemographics and postal codes, but very easily personalizable as well, that determine in advance the kinds of service that people can expect to obtain. Many other examples of this that connect the world of circulating information within information networks with the real world of everyday life. So the huge focus on identification and digital identity management that has become especially strong since 9/11. Governing by ID has become an increasingly important concept in this field. And the same kinds of things that I've just said about geodemographics and marketing could be said here. Equally to urban informatics and the connection between access and egress from buildings and building codes, the use of roads, both from road tolling systems, automated number plate recognition systems, and so on and so forth. Increasingly, urban spaces are also divided and classified in these sorts of ways. Then, of course, the one that many people have been talking about over the course of these 2 days, Web 2.0, networking, social networking sites. And there again, we know very well that these are not merely out there in some kind of separate cyber realm. They are intimately connected with everyday life. I'm sure you, as I do, have friends who, when you ask them how they met, for example, they met a life partner. "Oh, I met on the internet." And I met last week the one-year-old child of a partnership that began online. So some very intimate and physical connections between this supposed world out there and our world down here. And as I say, I don't believe that there ever were those disconnects that some theorists argued about in the 1990s. If you take something like Facebook there, as in any other realm, there are many new opportunities for all kinds of networking, and they're being opened all the time. And we just heard about the Google-Facebook connection. But here, there are various inevitable consequences of using Facebook. Personal information flows in new ways. Individual identities being diffused across fractured spaces. New forms of peer surveillance, where one person or groups of people can watch what others are doing. The vast majority of those who are engaged with most of the social networking sites are actually lurkers and people who are not actively uploading things. There are many, many people who are involved on the edges and on the fringes, plus the external surveillance from corporations. Database sorting occurs on Facebook using age, gender, information about media preferences, music, and so on, political and religious views. But they can also be used by intermediary groups, not just the corporations or police under certain circumstances, but also by other kinds of agencies, such as high schools and universities, who have become highly adept at using instruments like this. So you find also classifications regarding underage drinking, national security threats, supposed or real, job eligibility or ineligibility when it comes to job seeking. Now, some of these have been dramatized in the media, and it tends to be the gossip-worthy that are most frequently noticed. It's those individual cases where someone has become a celebrity or has become notorious. It's a particular case. And while those sell newspapers and TV stories, it is the much more subtle kinds of surveillance that occurs through things like social networking sites, geodemographic marketing, and so on and so forth, that I think are particularly interesting and important. It's very easy in a world where the celebrated is, when the person who is celebrated is central, to miss those subtle forms of surveillance. If we were to spend some time thinking about the connections between the physical space around us and our online activities, we would find that there is a mushrooming of new kinds of connections between the two. And I've become very interested in the last few years in what we might call mobile surveillance. Of course, once upon a time, you might have imagined that your physical mobility, your movement through space, would be the means of evading the watchful eye. And of course, today, there's no chance of that. The watchful eye is now embodied in the environments, and in fact we carry on our persons the means whereby we are constantly under surveillance of one kind or another. So in this world where we could talk about geolocative systems, in other words, systems that locate us, situate us, find us, trace us, track us in space, geolocative systems are of various kinds. Two really important ones are location technologies themselves. That is to say, the kinds of technologies that we all are aware of in mobile phones, cell phones, and also ones connected with GPS, global positioning satellites. Now, those are important because they offer the possibility of continuous, real-time location of anyone who is in possession of or carrying one of these devices. They pinpoint place to within increasingly accurate dimensions, within a meter or two, and they do so, as I say, continuously and in real time. There's also the world of radio frequency identification, RFIDs. And, let me just give you one example of the previous one. Location technologies, there are very many kinds of them for all kinds of tracking. And you see them for tracking goods and persons and for emergency services using cell phone location systems and so on and so forth. Right through to crime control and the location of offenders. So one of the areas that's become increasingly important is that of tracking offenders who have been tagged. So electronic tagging of offenders is now increasingly being done using GPS, so that you no longer simply have to have a radius around a fixed telephone link, but rather the GPS device is actually in the tracking system. One of those companies that has become very important both in Canada, the United States, and in several Western European countries is called iSecure. And iSecure makes the promise that to probation officers and those who are in that kind of a field, that while they couldn't possibly keep track of the persons who are under probation and in their field of responsibility, iSecure checks every 10 seconds. So it's that kind of promise that is being given in the field of crime control, and those sorts of that kind of illustration gives you a sense of the ways in which the continuous real-time pinpointing is significant. The other sort that I was just going to mention, RFIDs, generally to do with entry and exit into fixed locations. And these aren't continuous in real time. They depend upon your passing through the thing being scanned or contactless passing nearby the scanner. But they have also become important for tracking, not so much in real time, but very shortly afterwards, there it's possible to trace in space where people are. So that, for example, visa waiver categories of passports in the United States are now RFID enabled. So are the Oyster cards carried by people who live in London using the London, England transportation system. And in both cases, they can be used to track individuals, and increasingly, police are being given access to those systems, such that what is there for a commercial purpose or for border crossing purposes may also be used by police. So, geolocative systems becoming increasingly important. I'm not going to say more about those, although I think they're adding a very important new dimension that we haven't yet properly explored or understood to the layers of personal data collection in the in surveillance, as I defined it earlier. Ubiquitous information is the outcome of the increasing mobile surveillance that goes along with the forms of more fixed surveillance that we have become familiar with. They all allow for greater tracing and tracking and monitoring. They're embedded in objects, in our bodies, and in our environments. And they all lead to different forms of social sorting. And because that's the particular focus that I am to give this afternoon, I want to just say a few more things about how the social sorting occurs from such surveillance devices and systems. One major one has to do with opportunity maximization. Now, you heard me say in the little interview segment at the beginning that I regard surveillance not as something that is somehow connected with the Big Brother nation state. It is connected with the Big Brother nation state, but not merely and only. It's connected with every dimension, every sphere of life today. And increasingly, those spheres each carry their own forms of power relation. And increasingly, each of those spheres may be interconnected with the others. And they are to various degrees and according to certain limits. Some of those limits are legal limits, some of them are technical limits, some of them are organizational limits. I'm not pretending that there is somehow the tentacles of some all-knowing surveillance system that is embracing all of us. Neither am I suggesting that such a system is somehow entirely negative, malign, sinister, and inappropriate. I'm not for a moment. Surveillance is always ambiguous, and even in the definition that I gave you, there are many purposes there in which surveillance may be seen as empowering, entitlement, for example. It is empowering as well as disempowering. It involves positive as well as negative relations in many contexts. Now, of course, much of what is positive about interactive data gathering systems is crowed about by the companies that produce these things, and we have no lack of positive appreciation that's given in the advertising materials. What there is less of is an explanation of the parallel consequences that may not be as beneficial as ones that are publicly advertised. So forgive me if I focus on those that are perhaps less crowed about by the companies that create them. Opportunity maximization and risk management are two key ways by which these kinds of surveillance occur today. Opportunity maximization is by and large a commercially, corporately, usually profit-driven dimension of surveillance, in which you try to capture as much data as possible about individuals and about groups to which they belong. You want to know about demographic preferences, about communications. You want to know about all kinds of everyday, mundane details such that they can be manipulated within statistical systems that, with computer power, are now usually referred to as data mining. Coming into Linz yesterday, newspaper that was not in German was the Financial Times. And so that was the one that I read. And I'm sorry that I don't read German, but the Financial Times carried a very little interesting little piece on a book by somebody called Michael Ayers on the power of statistical reasoning in the corporate realm. And he showed how when airlines have to cancel a flight, using regression analysis and knowledge of the customers who are using airlines, they are unlikely, apparently, today to say anything to those who are already frequent flyers, those who are known to be loyal to a particular airline. Will not be apologized to, will not be reached out to by the corporation. Because their regression analysis has shown them that there are other people out there who might never fly with that airline again after their flight was canceled. And so they'll go for the group not of frequent flyers, but the group of those who they would like to become frequent flyers with their corporation. So there's one way in which the data mining is useful to them. Equally, credit card users who want to close their account. Well, those who are credit card users about to close their accounts will be sifted through by the data mining of the credit card company, and they will only pursue those who have a very clear LTV. Do you know what LTV is? You all have one. I have one. It's your lifetime value. Remember, your lifetime value is a crucial component of all these systems when you are dealing in the surveillance realm of corporations. They want to know your lifetime value. That is to say, not what you spend today, but what the spending that you do today tells them about 5 years down the road, 2 months down the road. They want to know about what is going to happen, and that is what interests them. So they'll check your LTV. Those with a very clear profit benefit for the corporation, for the credit card corporation, will be wooed. They will be sought after, and they will try to ensure that they don't cancel their account. Others will simply fall by the wayside. They'll be neglected, allowed to drop off. So do you see what I'm saying? How differential treatment occurs without our knowledge, without any accountability of the corporations, the organizations concerned. In fact, to this point, with very little ethical scrutiny, let alone political questioning, or participation in the kinds of decisions that are made about who falls into what category and what sorts of consequences there may be for them because of the category in which they are found. Opportunity maximization, one of the crucial motifs of contemporary surveillance systems on a corporate basis. The other, risk management. Risk management has been around, and very importantly, for the last 25, 30 years. Here, it is potential harm and liability that is in mind. So the first was positive, how you can maximize opportunities. This one is negative, how you can minimize harms. And it's within this one that forms of security and policing and other kinds of surveillance become tremendously important. This is seen in all sorts of public spaces, and it occurs in urban areas particularly, but in all such areas, including, obviously and especially since 9/11, airports. So malls, public streets, semi-public places, all these are subject to risk management kinds of activities. And these too get us classified as risky people with higher threat levels or higher levels of dangerousness, or with lower levels. We're classified according to those kinds of criteria. A couple of weeks ago, there was a major event that happened just north of Ottawa in Canada. It was a meeting between a peace and prosperity and security meeting in Montebello. And this was a meeting of the American, Canadian, and Mexican leaders in order to develop policies for, well, as they would put it, opening borders to trade and closing borders to terrorism. Wonderful, contradictory way of conceiving of borders, and it's the fundamental contradiction that is present in all current border policy work. Opening borders for trade, closing borders to terrorism. And so the three leaders, Calderon, Bush, and Harper, got together to discuss these matters. Well, of course, there were plenty there who also went to protest the situation. And Felix showed us in the last segment this morning pictures of flying over a G8 meeting in Germany, pictures taken of the camp of protesters. There may have been other dimensions to that in Germany, but in the Canadian case, what happened was that the rights of citizens were respected, such that those who were protesting and who were there to protest were given free and open opportunities to do that. Now, unlike the CEOs of corporations, they weren't invited into the room with Harper, Calderon, and Bush, but they were given the opportunity. In the protest area, there was a tent set up, and in that tent were CCTV cameras and with video cameras with sound, and protesters were welcomed to come into this area. So free speech and democratic participation was ensured so that people could come into the tent, and they were promised that the leaders would watch the video of these protesters making their point, venting, generally explaining what they were there for. Well, it's a curious situation when the argument for democratic participation is made through an invitation to be to present in front of video cameras. Because, of course, what was recorded on that occasion was used for all kinds of other purposes as well. And who knows whether the leaders ever did watch the video of the protesters explaining why they were there. Naomi Klein had a really neat article in The Nation, it was republished in one or two places in Canada too, in which she pointed out that basically what you have here is the new security is prosperity, and she showed how the security companies are actually the biggest beneficiaries from such two-border, three-country agreements. So the prosperity of the peace, the prosperity and security is very much in the security, and the surveillance is the new democracy. Read the article for yourself. You can find it online. But I think that's a really neat illustration of the ways in which those kinds of activities can so easily be co-opted within the world, and particularly the world that Felix was describing just before lunch. So what am I saying then? That linked searchable databases are now crucial for all kinds of surveillance. Links can be made and are being made constantly between data fragments. Ranked for their relevance, sorted into categories so that different groups can be treated differently. In the talk that I prepared to give, I was going to discuss Google as the model of the new surveillance, and I'll just leave it there. I'll leave you to think about Google as the model for surveillance. I think it's a perfect example, because what Google does is to link, rank for relevance, and to sort. That's precisely what Google does, and of course it does it precisely with our personal data constantly. And Google, too, wishes to become the world's most important source of data. They want to become the perfect search engine. And yet, from what I've been saying to you, it must be clear that that perfect search engine has direct implications for our choices, our life chances, and that is why it's so significant and why we need to think about it so carefully. The spaces in which we live, both those spaces online within social networking sites and so on, and the spaces of our everyday lives that are increasingly connected with those, are ones that are sorted spaces. And without thinking of them as sorted spaces, we're not going to understand what surveillance is all about today. But we also have to understand how they connect with other kinds of technologies. These are the sorts of things that were being referred to by Brian Holmes this morning. For example, the association of new technologies, nanotechnologies, biotechnologies, and so on. The one that is most significant and growing fastest at the moment is biometrics. Biometrics itself gives a new dimension, again, to the sorts of surveillance that I've been discussing. But the other thing is the political economic context. New technologies are one thing, but the political economic context that is also emerging is tremendously important. Felix and others made reference to the role of the executive state, the executive within the nation state. That's tremendously important, but we also have to think about the routine organization of what happens within any nation state today. During the 20th century, and particularly in the latter half, many people thought of ourselves as living within a welfare state. Or there were aspirations to create welfare states. Or, of course, there were arguments against welfare states. That is no longer the criterion. Increasingly, we all inhabit what are now emerging as much more safety states. It's safety which is the criterion, and that's also connected with security, but if you put it in terms of safety, then it connects much more with the individual, and it's something that it's far more easy for us to associate with. Start to think of the relation between citizens and the safety state rather than the welfare state, and you get a much better idea of what is driving governance in general, and surveillance that feeds into that governance. I mentioned this in the catalog, and it's there in both German and English, so you can see what I'm trying to say there in brief. So I'm not going to explain that further here. How does it relate to the goodbye privacy theme? Well, I think that privacy is important. There are ways in which it can be argued for and should be argued for. And I'm not really saying anything against privacy as conventionally construed, as construed, for example, by Helen Nissenbaum when she talks about contextual integrity, as construed by Priscilla Reagan when she talks about the social and common and public dimensions of privacy. All those things, I think, are important. What bothers me, what concerns me, is that the kinds of surveillance I've been talking about rather sidestep those kinds of issues, important and significant though they are in their own right. Privacy discussions frequently end up with the private individual. They frequently revolve around the sense that we have to say when we have been violated, when our lives have been intruded upon. It comes down to a very personal level. But equally, in terms of legal and rule-based provision, it turns out to be our responsibility to respond in some way. We have to buy these pets, these privacy-enhancing technologies. We have to be more aware of the systems that we're using. We have to find protections. We have to go to a court of law or to a privacy commissioner and tell them when something has gone wrong as we see it. That, it seems to me, misses the point. A lot of what we've been talking about is invisible, is opaque, is unknown to us. A lot of what we've been talking about affects whole categories of people, not just little me. The kinds of surveillance that we've been talking about is not to do with singular, fully formed individual persons, but to do with data fragments that flow around and are concatenated and combined and uncombined again in different ways. It's a very different kind of thing that we're talking about. And as I pointed out already, the means whereby these are done are highly unaccountable, highly unscrutinized, highly, they become very separated from any kind of democratic participation or involvement. Actuarial criteria rule, that is to say, we're being identified, managed, classified by the sorts of criteria that I was referring to earlier on. Your LTV, your lifetime value, or your level of dangerousness. We can make all kinds of privacy provisions, and the machine rolls on anyway. We might be able to preserve some little moment of what we think of as privacy, but the system just continues. Larger and larger layers of data images are being screened. So to speak merely of misidentification, that is to say, you didn't get me right, or to speak about, you need a fuller picture of who I am before you can make that judgment, or of give me access to my data, let me see what you've collected on me. These are all largely irrelevant questions to the kinds of surveillance that I've been talking about. We're talking about multiple images being used in statistical ways, using regression analysis in data mining in order to make inferences that lead to preemptive and increasingly precautionary kinds of measures. I haven't talked about precaution, but precaution, again, has become tremendously important. So, while I think that privacy may be important, it is not a lack of privacy that is the problem in what I've been discussing. It's the lack of public spaces in which we can see and be seen to engage the difficulties and the differences of our world. A right to be freely visible in public spaces, virtual or physical, without suspicion or judgment. Those are the issues, not privacy. Thank you.
David, thank you so much for this very, very important conclusions. I think they brought it really to the point. It's also our concept, not just to focus on the questions of privacy, but to look after our public life, the published life, and the public spheres. So that's, I think, a very important shift of the whole debate. And I now want to invite the audience to make your comments and ask questions. I think we got 10 minutes or... Okay.
David, your example of the call center really annoyed me because I'm that person that's on hold for all those minutes. But I would like to understand what's wrong with... I feel in my gut that it is wrong and it is something to be worried about, but what is wrong with social sorting?
That's a very good question. And again, just as I said with surveillance in general, I don't regard social sorting as an essentially negative or sinister kind of activity. We all base our lives on various kinds of discrimination. And it is a very natural and positive thing that we're involved in all the time. What concerns me about it is the ways, as I described it, are the ways in which it is increasingly opaque. That is to say, we don't know the basis on which decisions that affect life chances of whole groups of people, and we too are those who are involved, are taken on the basis of criteria that are completely unknown to us. We don't know how that works. And the example from the Financial Times yesterday was a revelation to me, because I didn't know how banks are now organizing their activities. It was a move forward from the kind of data mining I was aware of in the banks. So it's always changing. It's a fluid situation. So it does seem to me that, again, in contrast to the welfare state and the kinds of criteria there, the criteria that developed within welfare state thinking were very public ones. The decisions that were made about people's life chances and choices within a welfare state context were ones that were amenable to democratic participation and involvement in the process whereby the categories are made up and were open to appeal and so on and so forth. So I think it's that question of openness and transparency in a positive sense that is at the heart of this. You see, part of the issue is that although these questions are being presented to us as very new, you know, 21st century online worlds and so on and so forth, they relate to some very basic questions of fairness and justice. And that's the point at which it really grates with me, and that's why I get passionate about it, and that is also why I go on doing this work at the Surveillance Project, because at heart, if you scratch me, it's not the, you know, the superficial and the even the intellectual fun of being of trying to understand surveillance systems. It's this basic point that people's life chances are crucially affected. I mean, the same credit card companies, for example, were involved directly after 9/11, doing some pretty unsubtle mining and sorting. And there was one credit card company working in your own city in New York, which actually closed the accounts of all those account holders who had the name Muhammad. That was a direct post 9/11 result. Now, there's a very different kind of sorting. And if you mention that one, you think, well, was there no accountability there? Well, good question. So, yeah, there are many forms of sorting that are highly beneficial, entitle people, and you know, are very positive. But there are others that, in their opacity and their lack of amenability to public scrutiny, seem to me to be basically unfair.
Thank you. Okay,
David, thanks for that talk. I want to ask you a question. You refer often in your work to Anthony Giddens' notion of a dialectic of control, or in other words, a kind of push-pull relationship over the, you know, the surveillance game. And what do you think is the university's role in this dialectic of control? This transnational network that you've helped to set up seems to me to be something like this kind of new kind of institutionality that I'm personally looking for. And I very much admire the project, but sometimes when I read the essays, which is a web-based publicational platform, you know, I'm confronted with what seems to be a lot of career rivalry, you know? I mean, what kind of political valence do you think can be generated from this type of institution in terms of the dialectics of control?
I tend I think there are some things within that dialectic of control idea. I mean, basically, Giddens argues that some of the key forms of power in modernity have, it seems, generated their own forms of resistance and opposition. I'm not entirely happy with that characterization of it, but I think it's a helpful heuristic for obliging us to ask some questions about what is being generated to counteract the negative aspects of surveillance as I described it. You ask about the university. Just let me put that in a broader context that it was occurring to me yesterday and today in our discussions. And that is that we haven't really talked about the range of possibilities for oppositional activity and resistance where surveillance may be negatively construed. And I think that's important because I would argue that just as surveillance affects us and our everyday lives and the lives of the organizations to which we belong and so on at very many levels, so the opportunities for countervailing activities when there is something that we perceive to be negative, inappropriate, or whatever, are manifold. That there is no one kind of approach that is significant for an oppositional movement. And I think it's really important to think of that multi-level approach to surveillance issues today. I was thinking that we've heard very little about what people like computer professionals for social responsibility do. There are lots of computer and information science professionals who are doing very interesting work, and they could be working, and in some cases do, alongside and with artists and social scientists and others. So I think that's important. The direct question about the universities, I think there's great opportunity within the universities, not least because the universities themselves are so profoundly involved in this very activity. And yet, in some ways, they don't simply mirror either governmental activities, I mean in the formal sense, nation-state, or commercial activities. However much some people might lament the corporatization of the university, they haven't gone completely corporate. Queen's University, for example, has the opposite approach to personal data collection on our campus. So you find that the CIO, the Chief Information Officer, actually aims to keep as little data as possible. So unlike the precautionary, which gathers as much as you can, or the opportunity maximization, which gathers as much as it can, the university is increasingly operating in an opposite way. So there may be currents within the university that can be exemplary for how an organization can operate without such constant data gathering. But the university groups themselves, academics, I think can both work with their university organization, but also encourage multidisciplinary forms of analysis. And that, the more I work with a multidisciplinary group, the more I think this is fundamental to forming any kind of intelligent, informed, appropriate resistance. So I do think that multidisciplinarity is crucial there.
One more question from the audience. Many questions, but not so much time. Maybe you can, all of you can ask short questions and then we give one conclusion answer. Try to, and then we continue our program.
Got to stand up. I have a project that takes these demographic marketing profiles you're talking about and delivers them to people in a vehicle as they move through these spaces. And it's done a really good job of creating awareness in people. People are really fascinated that this kind of surveillance exists. But I guess I'm wondering how we can take that to the next level, and if you have ideas or suggestions or comments about how we can move beyond awareness to actually affecting the practices.
Maybe we collect the questions, okay?
David, a very interesting presentation. I wondered if you draw a distinction in the current technical environment between observation and surveillance, being observed at a CCTV point and being surveilled through a system.
Okay. Maybe you can give a short answer. Yeah.
I think the first question about awareness is a really important one, and there are many people, I think, who, like you, are involved in those kinds of systems who can build into the systems some means of enhancing the awareness of the users or those who are beneficiaries of the system. But I do think the basic point that I'm making about the opacity, the opaqueness of most such systems is crucial. And the more those who organize such systems do so in, or who design them, do so in a way that encourages participants or those who are being observed or those who are users of the system to be aware of the wider dimensions of what they're doing, the better. We could talk afterwards about illustrations of that, and I think it's important to do so. Observation and surveillance. There are many ways in which observation can occur that are not necessarily surveillant ones. My definition, though broad, does give us some means of determining when it really is surveillance of that systematic kind, using or drawing upon that personal attention, the focused attention to personal details for certain kinds of purposes. CCTV systems may do observation. I mean, in their classic sense, it is individuals before screens in analog systems, undigitized. Their categorization is based entirely on their preconceptions of criminality or dangerousness or abnormality. Such observations still involve judgments and decisions, but then they're not necessarily fully surveillant in the sense that I was using it. But, you know, we would have to... We're looking at a continuum between that kind of observational and the actually surveillant. And again, we can talk about that further.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks.